upon you all to address the audience on the topic that you would chose.
Thank you, Mr. Gawa. And ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Finley and I are very privileged to be here tonight. I feel very much at home, first of all, because in the United States, on a number of occasions, I've had the opportunity to be with the people of the Muslim faith. And it's always a great inspiration and pleasure to hear the words of the Quran spoken in Arabic as well as in English, to sense the common roots of Christianity and Islam is an experience that unfortunately most Americans have not had. But it's one that I've had on a number of occasions. I feel very much at home for another reason. I'm a Christian, a member of the Presbyterian Church. The church auditorium is not always full on Sunday morning. And I've noticed that without exception, the front row seats are always empty, as they are here tonight. There's something about front row seats that seems to repel people. Now, those people in the rear of the auditorium, if you begin to feel lonesome or want to have a closer look or perhaps hear better, please feel free to come forward. I like to be able to see you, and I can only see dimly the outlines of the people in the back. So if any of you feel inspired about coming up front, please do so. I have a word of assurance for you also. Mrs. Finley is my timekeeper. You'll notice that if I begin to drag on my comments, she'll take her watch off her wrist and hold it up to her ear to see if it's still running. And if I don't notice that and continue speaking, she will stand up, and if I don't notice that, she will come down to the front and walk down the aisle and leave the auditorium. And that's the final signal for me to sit down and quit talking. So be assured I have a good timekeeper with me tonight. I'm not Ahmed Didot. Need I say that? I know him only as a personality that Mrs. Finley and I had seen on our television set. I'm not sure how many miles separate Durban and our home in Jacksonville, Illinois, but it must be 10,000 miles, wouldn't you say? Well, 10,000 miles away last week, we saw Ahmed Didot in our living room on television. That's our only experience with him. I wish I had his magic of expression. He's a very able communicator and one who presents his message with such skill that I am sure he's a great inspiration to everyone who hears him. And I have to add that I approached the symposium in Cape Town with some apprehension, sharing the platform with a man of such great strength of personality and message. But already I feel that I know him and see him as one of the remarkable people of this generation, a person who is doing so much to create awareness and understanding of the Muslim faith. I hope that time will permit him to carry his message widely in the United States. You know, the United States, in a sense, is a Muslim country, but it hasn't awakened as yet to that fact. Some estimates indicate that there are as many as 10 million Americans who are Muslims. At the time of the great World War II, there were almost no Muslims whatever within the population of the United States. The introduction of the Muslim faith has occurred almost entirely since the end of World War II. And yet it has been so gradual, and the presence of people of the Muslim faith has been so unobtrusive, so quiet, that hardly any of the others who are citizens of the United States are aware of it. And the time has come for Christians and Jews in the United States to know about the Muslim faith, to understand it. Our nation, unfortunately, is afflicted with a lot of stereotypes which are based on ignorance, to some extent, result from deliberate policy on the part of those who would like the Muslim tradition, the Arab world, those who are a part of what is called Islamic civilization, to be regarded in a negative way. That's most unfortunate, but it's true. And when a person in our neighborhood in Jacksonville would be asked a question about the Muslim faith, about Islam, about the Quran, if that person had any response whatever, it would likely be one that is negative in its character, because they know so little about it. And what little understanding they have of the Muslim religion arises from these negative stereotypes. To most of them, the Muslim religion is very distant. It's very far away. It's very strange. It seems quite apart from their way of life. Whereas the truth is that there are so many common threads within the Muslim faith that are common to Christianity. I'm sure because of the preaching of Ahmadinejad, you are very aware of the commonality between Christianity and the Muslim faith. But unfortunately, it is little known in the United States. In any case, I thank very much the Islamic Propagation Center International for making it possible for Lucille and myself to be here for this, our first experience in South Africa, and especially for the opportunity to be with you tonight. You may wonder why it is that a congressman from a rural agricultural part of a Midwestern state would have written a book about Israel's lobby and how it affects the life of my country. Well, it came about quite by accident, by chance. One of my constituents became a prisoner in the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. Has anyone in the room ever visited the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen? Would you raise your hand if you had? Well, I'm not surprised. It's sort of an outpost. It's right at the entrance to the Red Sea. It's a state that is heavily influenced by the Soviet Union. Its people are very poor. They're few in number. They are very oppressed in many ways. One of my constituents became a prisoner there. He was considered wrongly as a spy, was arrested, put in prison. And being his congressman, his family looked to me for help, as they often do. One of the jobs of being a member of the U.S. Congress is to try to be helpful to one's constituents, and if one of them gets in trouble in a foreign land, it's natural for them to look to their congressman to do what he can to bring about some relief. Well, our government then, this is 1974, had no diplomatic relations with the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. In fact, we still don't, despite the strategic importance of that country. So I had to communicate indirectly through the British Foreign Office by going to the United Nations to appeal to the ambassador of South Yemen in behalf of my constituent. I finally got word that if I ever wanted to see my constituent alive again, I should go myself to South Yemen, to the People's Democratic Republic, capital is Aden, and make a direct plea for his release, which I did. It was an event of enormous importance to that young man, of course. It led to his release. But it was an event of enormous importance to me as well, because it gave me my first look, direct look, at the Muslim world, at Arab sensitivities. The first time I was able to listen to the problems of the Arab states, which are neighbors to the State of Israel. As a member of Congress, I had joined my colleagues in universal and critical support of the State of Israel. This was a habit that every one of us had at that time. We had been convinced that the only case that needed to have attention was the case presented to the Congress by the State of Israel. No other voice needed to be listened to. Well, in the process of getting my constituent out of prison, I listened to officials of Lebanon, to the president of Syria, and to a number of officials of South Yemen. And I heard for the first time the Arab side of the problem. And when I got back to Congress, I began to raise questions about U.S. policies in the Middle East. Were we wise to always be on the side of Israel, to provide Israel with the money and the weapons and the support it wanted, no matter what Israel did? And because I raised challenging questions, I became the target of the lobby that operates with great efficiency in behalf of the State of Israel. And when election time came around in 1980, the lobby did its best to defeat me. They didn't make it. They cut in very substantially in the margin that I had had in the polls the time before. My vote was 70% of my constituency in 1978. It dropped down to 53%, from 70% down to 53%. In 1980. Still, I won. But the next time around, I had the same handicaps. Israel's lobby was totally, forcefully against my re-election. From all over the nation came money to my opponent. It was the most expensive political campaign that Illinois had ever seen. And I was defeated by this tiny margin. Well, I didn't feel too good about losing. One likes to win when in a political contest, but it turned out to be, I think, the best thing that ever happened to me in the political field. It gave me the time to ponder some very important questions. How far did the arm of Israel's lobby reach in the United States? Was I the only one who felt its heavy hand? How about the executive branch of government headed by the president? Was it immune from Israel's lobby? How about academia, the great universities and colleges? How about Main Street and suburbia and the countryside of America? Was this an aberration that caused me to have so much difficulty at the hands of Israel's lobby? Or did its tentacles reach throughout the countryside with a paralyzing effect upon some of our most cherished political institutions? While being defeated, I had some time on my hands. I had the time to seek out the answers to these questions. And the result is contained in the volume that you see outside the hall. And perhaps some of you will have the interest to look into it. I hope you will. Let me just summarize briefly what I found out. First of all, I found that my experience was not exceptional. That Israel's lobby through an organization called the American Israel Public Affairs Committee has a network of people throughout the entirety of the United States. These people have developed a relationship with their congressmen, with their senators, and with the President of the United States. And when a challenge comes along, this network of people is called into action with great effect. If an amendment needs to be defeated or passed, if money needs to be approved for the State of Israel, this network is ready to act. If an enemy of Israel appears on the scene, like myself, this vast network is ready to go, raising money, causing agitation, providing support for the assault upon that critical element in the landscape, namely myself. But I was not the only one to be attacked. When Charles Percy, whom I'm sure many of you have heard of, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was up for re-election 2 years after my defeat, the lobby then focused its resources against him. And there's no question but what the decision on the part of the supporters of Israel was critical in bringing about the opposition of a congressman named Paul Simon as Charles Percy's opponent. No question also that more than $3 million came to the opposition to the re-election of Charles Percy from the supporters of Israel. In my own campaign, you might be interested to know that donations to the campaign treasury of my opponent in both of these last two elections came from every state in the Union. Now, my constituency was just a small portion of downstate Illinois, the heart of the state of Illinois, a remote area without any great political significance, and yet money to my opponent came from every one of the 50 states. It just shows you how active and how effective the work of this network can be in the political scene. I could cite a number of other examples, but I won't. Recently on CBS television appeared the 60 Minutes program, which perhaps you see here in this country, the 60 Minutes program in which Mike Wallace is one of the personalities. He interviewed Charles Percy just this last fall on that segment, and Charles Percy said that Israel's lobby is more powerful than the Congress and the President put together. That was his assessment. To illustrate the extraordinary influence of the lobby, it brings about the gift of $3 billion a year. I guess that would be about the equivalent of 9 billion rands a year to the State of Israel. The equivalent of about 3,000 rands per year for every man, woman, and child who lives in Israel. All of it a gift, no strings attached. An automatic provision of this sum to the State of Israel. It happens every year. And there's no argument against it. No one raises a question. No one demands that the votes be recorded. No one offers an amendment. The money simply flows. Even though the same year, There will be efforts to cut back on aid to education, aid to farmers, aid to small business, even the money for the military strength of our nation is cut back by the same Congress that automatically provides this enormous sum of money to the state of Israel. Why is it? The answer is very easy to find. The members of the House and Senate are convinced that if they challenge what Israel wants, they will pay a price the next time Election Day rolls around. They point to my experience. They point to the experience of Charles Percy, to the experience of Adlai Stevenson, who was served once in the Senate and tried to get elected governor of Illinois, to the experience of a man named Pete McCloskey of California. And they don't need many examples to convince them that here is a powerful influence on Election Day, and they'd better beware. And the result is that they are petrified. George Ball, who was Jack Kennedy's Undersecretary of State, and later Lyndon Johnson's ambassador to the United Nations, said that congressmen are like trained poodles. When Middle Eastern issues come along, they jump through the hoop held by the State of Israel. They're like a bunch of trained poodles. And much as I like my former colleagues of the Congress and on most fronts respect what they do, his assessment is correct. But the problem doesn't end there. The problem exists in the executive branch as well. The executive branch is penetrated to an alarming degree by friends of Israel, employees of the U.S. government, who are also deeply devoted to the State of Israel. They may be Jews, they may not be Jews, but for whatever reason, they have this deep attachment to what Israel wants. And these people do not hesitate to violate public law and steal secrets of enormous importance. Secrets about military affairs. Secrets about the military capacity and equipment and deployment of friendly states in the Arab world, for example. And these people are so ardently supportive of the State of Israel that they do not hesitate to violate the law and provide this classified information that should not be disclosed to anyone, provided to the State of Israel. A senior diplomat told me when I was preparing for my book that the leaks of classified information by supporters of Israel to that state are fantastic. He used that term. Let me cite one example that may on the surface seem amusing, but to me it is a very serious matter. After the 1973 war that Israel had with its neighbors, Israel had to replenish its stockpile of tanks. And the U.S. government went to great extremes to replenish Israel's inventory of tanks, and in the process sent some outdated units that required a special 90-millimeter size ammunition for the cannons on the tanks. Well, when the tanks arrived, the military leadership of Israel was upset because they had no ammunition to fit that type tank. And they sent an urgent plea to Washington, please send a supply of 90-millimeter ammunition so that these tanks will be useful in case we need them. Well, our Pentagon officials sent cables around to the various warehouses worldwide where we keep ammunition for tanks and other equipment and determined that our government had no inventory of 90-millimeter ammunition, whatever. And they sent word back, we're sorry we don't have any, but we'll start up the production lines, provide them as soon as we can. Well, a few days later, officials of the Israeli military high command sent a cable back to the Pentagon in Washington. They said, well, yes, you do. You have a supply of 90mm ammunition. Look in the Marine Corps warehouse on the island of Oahu in Hawaii, and you will find 15,000 rounds of 90mm ammunition. Well, they looked there, and sure enough, there was a supply of ammunition. Israel had penetrated our military establishment so thoroughly that it was able to make a more effective and complete check of inventory than our own military leadership could do. How about suburbia? How about Main Street? How about the great institutions of education? There, too, Israel's lobby has made a very skillful and effective penetration. I have two chapters in my book devoted to higher education. I hope you'll look at them. I think you'll find them very chilling reports. But let me cite just one example of penetration that has become rather public knowledge, not well enough known in my opinion, but nevertheless very prominent in the headlines. A man named Jonathan Pollard, an employee of the U.S. Navy, was arrested for carrying suitcases full of highly classified documents out of his workplace, copying them, and selling them to the State of Israel. Most people who steal documents for Israel don't get paid for it. But this man got $50,000 a year, I believe it was, for being a spy for the State of Israel. And one would think that our government would turn the other way and not even notice his stealing because it had had a number of files in its department, in the Justice Department, indicating that this type of thievery had been going on for a long time by many different individuals. But this man was stealing documents at such a great rate he could not be ignored. He was arrested. He finally pleaded guilty to spying and was sentenced to a life term and is now in prison. The only time that anyone has ever been brought to trial for stealing documents for the State of Israel, even though it's been going on for years at a very high level. But that's not the important part of the story, at least in my view. The two Israeli figures who worked most closely with Jonathan Pollard as a spy were promoted to higher positions by their government. When Jonathan Pollard went to trial, the government of Israel paid for his attorney. More than almost $200,000 came out of the treasury of the State of Israel to pay for the defense of this spy. And when the spy went to prison, his pay was doubled. They are now depositing $5,000 a month to the account of Jonathan Pollard, so when, if ever, he is released, he will have a nice nest egg. I cite this because it illustrates the arrogance, the defiant attitude on the part of the State of Israel in dealing with the U.S. government, the government which is literally the lifeline of the State of Israel, providing $3 billion a year, providing military support for the State of Israel, political support on all fronts. And yet, the beneficiary of this support has the gall to hire a spy and to pay for the spy's defense, to promote the handlers of the spy, and then to deposit $5,000, 15,000 rand every month to his personal bank account. Well, why is this so terrible? It's so terrible because it undermines the institutions of government which are most dear to me as a citizen of the United States. They undermine the integrity of our Congress, the place where open debate is cherished. They have so terrified the Congress that there is never any debate worthy of the term. From one end of the year to the other, on the question of what should be the right, the correct U.S. policies in the Middle East. U.S. policies in the Middle East are made in Israel, not in Washington. This tiny group of people so dedicated to the interests of the State of Israel have been able to bring about a stranglehold on the Congress, to penetrate the executive branch, to create a heavy cloud, depressing cloud throughout the nation where U.S. policy in the Middle East is concerned.